Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much, Brishus HaRabbanim, Rabbi Kalimnik, Rabbi Hochheimer. I'm delighted to be here in Rochester this morning. When I left, my wife said, I hope you take Rochester by storm. I didn't think she meant it literally. And in fact, I almost didn't make it here because I flew JetBlue. I almost have to give my talk from the tarmac. But very fortunately, I didn't have to, even though we were delayed some 5 hours, actually, on the New York side. They tell the story of a rabbi who was giving a lecture, and in the middle of his lecture, one of the congregants stood up and left the hall. And the rabbi was very offended at that time, but he didn't say anything. So a day or two later, he noticed this fellow on the street, and he said to him, sir, why did you leave my lecture? He said, Rabbi, I needed a haircut. Said, why didn't you take a haircut before the lecture? Said, Rabbi, I didn't need a haircut before your lecture. In order for us to cover the topic of the interface of science and medicine, the topic of transplantation alone, we would have to stay here until our hair would grow long. Just over the past year alone, just to give you an idea of the prominence of this topic, there have been 3 conferences in New York and Jerusalem, spanning a total, I think, of 6 days and many, many hours discussing all the intricacies of transplantation. So obviously there's no way we're going to be able to cover all those facets in our presentation today. My objective today is limited to give you an overview of some of the fascinating areas of different aspects of transplantation. And just to give you an idea of how relevant it is to our Jewish community, if anyone here subscribes to the Jewish press, you may have noticed in this week's Jewish press, and in fact in almost every week of the Jewish press, a number of ads that appear. One such ad: Dear brothers and sisters, I am a school-aged child suffering from kidney disease. You can grant me the gift of life by donating a kidney. Please call the following number. Just a few pages later in the same issue, which I just read over Shabbos, please help with an exclamation point. Save a Jewish mother of 7 young children suffering for 5 years. Desperately needs a kidney. Please call the following number. As I sat in the airport, I was actually thinking that the time that I spent roughly delayed is roughly the time that if a heart were transplanted or removed from a donor, the heart would be viable for roughly 4 to 6 hours. So my 5 hours at the airport would have been the time that after a heart would have been harvested, that a heart would have had to have been transplanted or the heart would have no longer been viable. I'd like to divide our discussion today into 3 sections. Section number 1 is living organ donation, donation from one living human being to another. Section number 2 is donation from the deceased after death. And section number 3 is new frontiers in transplantation, truly mind-boggling things that are being done in the field that are going to change the face of transplantation in our lifetimes. As we stand here or sit here today, how many people do you think are on the United Network of Organ Sharing list of people awaiting transplantation in the United States? Any ideas? Anybody want to hazard a guess? 50,000? It's like an auction. 50,000? Anybody for 60,000? 70,000? So as I checked last night at the airport, and they update their list on an hourly basis, there are roughly 96,203 people on that list. Now that list changes on an hour-by-hour basis, and it changes for a number of reasons. It could change because more people are receiving kidneys, or receiving livers, or receiving hearts. It could also change because less people are waiting on that list because tragically they have died waiting on that list. And that's really the tragedy. We live in an age where there is an ability to donate organs, and the lion's share of organs on this list, by the way, of those waiting on the list are for kidneys. About 80% of this 96,000 people list are awaiting kidneys. Yet, every year, thousands of people die on this list awaiting organs. So our objective is to find out what halacha has to say. What does our great tradition have to say about the donation of organs? We all know that we place a premium on the saving of life and pikuach nefesh. There's no doubt about that. But there are some complex issues on this interface of living and cadaveric donation. In the field of living donation, there are a number of organs that can be donated from one living human being to another. Does anybody know which organs today can be donated? You have to keep me awake because I didn't sleep very much. So if you don't answer, I may fall asleep standing. Kidneys, liver,
lung.
Absolutely correct. Now, liver and lung are a relatively new frontier of living donation. Kidneys have been along, we'll talk about this, kidneys have been around since the 1960s, kidney donation. Liver and lung donation are much more recent. There are other organs that can be donated, by the way, bone marrow. Corneas are after death. We'll talk about that in a few moments. And blood. Blood is also an organ, the largest organ in the body. Now, pancreas is another organ. Pancreas is donated from the deceased. So what does halacha have to say about living organ donation? So let us turn the page, and I'll share with you the following case. This is a real case from a few years back. There was a young girl by the name of Renata Patterson who, as the facts would have it, her parents were estranged one from another, and her father landed up in jail for some petty theft. It turns out that this young girl developed kidney disease and needed a kidney. So her father found out from prison, and he offered to donate a kidney, and indeed, he was a successful kidney donor. But one of the aspects of kidney donation, which we may touch on today, which is important to touch on today, is when you receive a kidney, normally your body will possibly reject that organ. Just like your body would reject a bacteria or attempt to reject a virus, when you receive an organ from another human being, your body considers that organ to be a foreign body and attacks it. So in order to preserve that organ in your body, you need to take a medicine. These medicines are called immunosuppressive medicines. They suppress your immune system. If you neglect to take those medicines on a daily basis for the rest of your life, and the science is changing, it may not be necessary to take it for the rest of your life, but currently it appears that way now, then your body will reject the organ. So this was a teenage girl, and she had been on dialysis for a number of years, and she was now, for the first time in her life, becoming a real teenager, not having been connected to a machine. So as you can imagine, she neglected to take the medicines that were required to preserve the kidney. So she rejected her father's kidney. So her father, upon hearing this news, made the following offer. He said, "Let me donate my second kidney to my daughter, and I'll go on dialysis, rather than my daughter go on dialysis." So the question that I ask you today, for us to discuss from a halachic perspective, is it appropriate in the eyes of Jewish law to serve as a kidney donor for that first kidney? How many people think, yes, it's appropriate to serve as a kidney donor? Is it appropriate in the eyes of Jewish law to serve as a kidney donor for his second kidney? So we have a couple hands that go up as a possible yes. So we'll see exactly what the halachic issues are, and that is the substance of the first section of our discussion today. So if we look on the handout, we will find this phrase on the very top of the handout. The reason why...
Which page are we on?
It's the first... I guess it's page 2. Which is the first source, the first page of sources. What would compel us to serve as a donor of any organ to another human being? So the origin for this desire within the Jewish tradition to serve as a donor of an organ comes from this phrase in Vayikra, in Leviticus, where it says, "Lo sa'amod al dam re'echa." Do not stand idly by as the blood of your brother is being shed. This is an extraordinarily important aspect of our Jewish belief. We care for each other. We take care of one another. So if somebody's life is at risk, or it's not even life necessarily, if somebody's finances is at risk, or they're about to make a bad deal, we have an obligation to care for that person and to intervene, a positive obligation. And interestingly, just as a parenthesis, In the state of Israel, there is a law called the Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa law. This could only happen in a Jewish state. If you're in the United States and there's a car accident and you could easily stop and help somebody or call the police, if you don't do anything, you're not held liable in American law. Quite the contrary, if you stop and you do harm, they're probably going to sue you. And there are some laws which would protect a physician or healthcare worker or any bystander. But in Israel, on the books, if somebody has an opportunity to help save somebody's life and they neglect that opportunity, they can be fined a certain amount of money. Extraordinary testimony to the power of the Jewish state. So the Torah tells us, Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa, but how does that manifest for us? How does that impact on our requirements to save somebody's life? What are the limitations? What are the requirements? What are the aspects that we have to translate to today? So here we turn to a Talmudic text. The text says, Gufa, minayin lo roes chavero shu tovea banahar, o chaya goroso, o listin boin elov, shu chayev latzilo. So how do we know, the Talmud asks, if somebody's life is at risk, if you see your neighbor, God forbid, drowning or being mauled by wild animals or being attacked by band of marauders, that you have to save him? How do you know this, the Talmud asks? So the Talmud says, we know this from the phrase, Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand idly by, the phrase we just mentioned. So then the Gemara asks the following question, is this the verse that we derived it from? We have another phrase in the Bible from which we could learn the same thing. What is that phrase? Avedas gufo minayin. If someone loses their body, how do we know you have to restore it? Talmud Lomar, the Torah teaches us, v'hashevosalo. You have to return a lost object to somebody. What is the greatest object that a person would want restored to them? The greatest object is their health, their body, themselves. So obviously, if a person is at risk of losing their body, you have a responsibility to restore that body. So the Talmud says, however, and I'll synopsize the rest, if there is an obligation only from this phrase of restoring lost objects, the Torah obligation of restoring lost objects is relatively limited. You have an obligation to physically restore an object the best you can. So for example, if this happened, I remember about a year or so ago, if I was in the airport and I noticed a pair of tefillin that somebody left in the airport. So I have an obligation to try and restore that tefillin. So what would my obligation include? So I'd put up a signs in local shuls, or I'd put up an email on mass email lists, which was done. And within a few days of that, in that particular circumstance, there were emails throughout the entire international Jewish world, and that person ultimately found his tefillin, and his tefillin was restored. So that I would have an obligation to do. But do I have an obligation to spend money to do it? Do I have an obligation to put an ad in the New York Times on the front page and spend $1,000 or $2,000 in order to restore the object to that individual? The answer is no. Not under that law of restoring lost objects. So that's why the Talmud says we need both phrases. We need v'hashevosalo and lo sa'amod al dam re'echa to teach us that not only do you have an obligation to physically help somebody, but you have an obligation to spend money to help save somebody's life. And this is indeed codified in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law from the 1500s, in our next source, where it reads, Haroes chavero tovea bayam, if you see somebody drowning, and this is excerpted from the Talmud, a listing boinolov, or attacked by robbers or wild animal, v'yachol lahatzilo, and you can physically save him. And it's a two-pronged obligation. Hu be'atzmo, either you yourself can physically save him, let's say you're on the side of the beach and you see a person got been drowning, you can rush in and save them, or sheyiskor acherim lahatzil, or you can hire somebody else to save that life. And the lo itzil, and you didn't do so, then you violate the obligations of the law. You violate Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa. But the one aspect of this obligation that is relevant to our discussion is missing. So you know you have a bodily obligation to try and save somebody's life. You know you have a financial obligation. But what if that obligation, or what if that rescue entails a certain amount of risk to the rescuer? That's already a different story. So that aspect is addressed for the very first time in our literature in the 1500s by Rav David ben Zimra in the last section of our handout. And here we have a very tragic case which is most likely a hypothetical, and none of us should ever be in such a circumstance, but it has, in our collective memories, it's reminiscent of tragedies in our past. And the question that was posed to Rabbi David Ben Zimmer was the following. Sha'alta mimeni, I was asked, Odiyacha dati, please render your opinion on the following case. Amar ha-shilton Yisrael, a dictator or a soldier stands in front of two Jews, and he says to one Jew, if you don't let me amputate one of your limbs, I'm going to kill the person standing next to you. What is our obligation? So there's three possibilities here. Possibility number one is lo samar ol dam re'acha. We have an obligation to save the life of somebody else. And this falls within the rubric of that obligation. Possibility number two is the other polar extreme. I not only have an obligation to preserve his life, I have an obligation to preserve my own life. V'nishmartem od l'nafsho seichem. And who says that his blood is any redder than mine? Possibility number three is, I am neither obligated nor forbidden, but I am permitted to engage in this type of rescue. And here, Rav David Ben Zimra sets out the parameters where he says, and we'll read it in the English, and I'll read from the second line of the English in the middle. Some claim he is obligated to endure the amputation since the organ is not vital. But what is his answer? The answer is that it is an act of piety. Clearly, to allow a limb to be amputated to save the life of another individual is an extraordinarily laudatory act, undoubtedly an act of tremendous piety. Furthermore, even though it is a non-vital organ, perhaps he may bleed excessively and die as a result. And who says his friend's blood is redder than his? Maybe his blood is redder. And he says, I have seen one die from a small incision of the ear, clearly a non-vital organ. They used to do bloodletting in the back of the ear. So it's possible that they cut an artery in the back and a person exsanguinated from such a procedure. Surely if the entire ear is cut off, there could be grave risk involved. Furthermore, it states, and this is his key phrase, Drachea Darche Noam, the Torah, the ways of the Torah are the ways of pleasantness. And he says, how can one imagine a law which would obligate a person to allow himself to be blinded or to have his hand or leg amputated in order to save the life of a friend? So he says, you are clearly not obligated to perform such a rescue. Therefore, I can only consider this an act of piety, though not obligatory, with clearly great benefit for one who could withstand such an ordeal. However, and this is the key line, he underlined at the end, if the rescue involves great risk, then the rescuer would be considered a pious fool, a chassid shote, for his questionable risk outweighs his friend's certain risks. And if you turn the page, I'll just share with you, we won't read this one inside, we'll just elaborate what David Ben Zimra says, his elaboration of this principle. So he basically defines three categories of risk with respect to this obligation of lo samar adam re'echa. Category number one is low, very low risk. And in such a case of low risk, so for example, you have a shotgun in your car and there's an animal escaped from the local zoo, and you can pull out your shotgun and you can save somebody. Or you see somebody sleeping under a wall that's about to tumble, you can tap on their shoulder and allow them to wake up to succumb to the falling wall. That you're clearly obligated to do. And even a slightly greater risk than that, you are obligated to do. However, if the risk to your life becomes so great, and we'll say for the sake of simplicity, although it's not so clear, that it's more than 50% that you will die in the course of the rescue, then you are prohibited from embarking on such a rescue. Because that is prohibited for you to do, to sacrifice your own life to save somebody else's. However, there's a huge gray area in between the obligatory and the forbidden. That gray area is left up to the individual to decide. If you want to do such a thing, tavo alecha bracha, it'll clearly be a laudatory act. If you don't want to, you're not obligated to do so. So how does this fit in to the aspect, to the living donations of today? So clearly for the donations like blood donation, bone marrow donation, how much risk is there involved in blood and bone marrow donation? Now, bone marrow donation used to be a more risky procedure. So is there a question?
It's very low risk.
It's very low risk. Right, absolutely. It's very low risk. Now, when we discuss these issues, and this I hasten to add, and I apologize if I say it again, and I probably will repeat myself on this, when we are talking about the interface of science and halacha, we must talk about the science of today, of this day, not even yesterday, because science is evolving on such a rapid basis, you can't look back at a decision that was made 50 years ago and try and apply it to today without updating the medicine. So donation of bone marrow used to be more complicated. They used to have to bore many holes in different parts of the bone. You'd clearly have to undergo general anesthesia. Nowadays, it's even possible to be a donor without accessing the bone marrow at all. You can access stem cells from the peripheral blood, and you don't need to bore a hole in the bone whatsoever. And the application of stem cell research is itself a very exciting topic, which we could perhaps address in the question and answer, what Halacha has to say about stem cell research. But there are poskim today, there are rabbinic authorities who say that one could be compelled to be a blood and bone marrow donor because the risk to you is so small and the tremendous benefit to the recipient is extraordinary. But let's move up a notch in terms of risk. What about, in our case of kidney donation? That's already a slightly higher level of risk. Because as opposed to bone marrow and blood, first of all, the kidney doesn't regenerate. You take bone marrow, and in a few months, you'll have a new bone marrow. If you take blood, in a few 120 days, you'll replenish your blood supply. But not so with the kidney. You only have one kidney. So the assessment from a halachic perspective of kidney donation is really twofold. One aspect is the surgical procedure itself. And that, again, is something which has been perfected since the onset of kidney surgery, of kidney transplant surgery in the 1960s. The procedure is done with minimal incision, relatively short procedure. The recovery time is literally a day or two now after donor surgery. But there's another dimension of risk, and that's the risk of living the rest of your life with one kidney. Is it permitted to take the risk of living the rest of your life with one kidney? Now, perhaps this is a reason God gave us two kidneys. Maybe we should have one kidney for donation. We have a spare. But we have to rely on science to assess this risk. And is it indeed risky for somebody who only has one kidney to live the rest of their life? And the answer is, and again, this may change in 20 or 30 years from now, the answer today in 2007 is that it is not a great risk. And how do we know this information? We know this information as we know many great advances in medicine from the military. So people, young soldiers who are perfectly healthy and have cleared the medical exams, go to war, and very tragically, as is a casualty of war, many of them get injured. They get injured with gunshot wounds to the abdomen. So thousands of soldiers have gunshot wounds to the abdomen that required removal of a kidney. They're otherwise healthy people. The gunshot wound caused abdominal injury, the kidney's been removed. And scientists have followed these people for decades to see if these young, healthy people who only have one kidney have any greater risk of developing high blood pressure, greater risk of developing diabetes, greater risk of developing kidney failure. So the answer is that it's a relatively small amount of people, of increase of kidney disease in people that only have one kidney. So today, the risk is a negligible risk. That's why it's acceptable to undergo kidney transplant in the secular community. So how would halacha approach kidney transplants? So in the 1960s, when kidney transplantation first came out, there was a concern about the risk to the donor. And at least two of the great rabbis, the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer of Oldenburg, who actually passed away just a few months ago, one of the giants of Jewish law, and in particular Jewish medical ethics, passed away in Jerusalem. And Diane Weiss, the author of the Minchas Yitzchak, said in the 1960s, you know what? The donating a kidney today in 1960s, put yourself into the category of chassid shote of David Ben Zimra, and it's prohibited for you to do. But what about today in 2007? Not a single rabbi would prohibit anybody from donating a kidney. Quite the contrary. Rav Avadya Yosef in our handout says he doesn't come out and say it completely, but he says the mitzvah is so extraordinary that he can't imagine actually compelling, but he comes close to obligating somebody to donate a kidney. How is this playing out in the Jewish community? Just a few, actually it's about a year ago now, somebody put up a small index card in one of the shuls in my neighborhood. And it said, in handwritten note, it said, need kidney, if anybody needs, anybody interested in donation, please call. 8 people in the shul called within the week. And one of them turned out to be a successful donor. That person who received the kidney, I think it was about a few months ago, it was about a year after the donation, he held a gala kiddush in honor of the kidney donor. Tremendously exciting event. On your handout, on this page in the middle right, you see a cover page of a book called Klayot Yoatzot. What does that mean, Klayot Yoatzot? The kidneys advise. It's a passage based on a passage from the Talmud, but the entire book is this question. Fascinating halacha question relating to organ donation. There was a member of Knesset, still today a member of Knesset, who needed a kidney donation. His doctor said he needed a living kidney donation. So he has 5 sons. When he came home, there was one son who happened to be home. That one son heard he needed a kidney donation. He took the first bus to Hadassah Hospital, had himself tested to see if he was a match. When he got home, the other 4 brothers had returned home, and they looked at him and they said, "What gives you the right to be the kidney donor to our father? We should be the kidney donor to our father." And the Bechor, the firstborn, says, "I not only have obligations as a Bechor, I have rights as a Bechor. And I should be the one to serve as a kidney donor." So there was this quagmire, and they had absolutely no idea what to do. So this entire book is that question based, which was presented to a rabbinic authority, to resolve this dilemma of who would have the great zchus, who would have the great honor of serving as a kidney donor. Right, it would be wonderful. But let's assume that they all were a good match. Then who would be the kidney donor? So the answer to this question I'll tell you at the end. Very interesting answer. And if anyone wants to try and think what the answer could possibly be, I'm open to suggestions. So with respect to living donation, it is clearly permitted, according to the eyes of Jewish law, to serve as a kidney donor. But what about liver and lung? So liver and lung are a little more complicated. Liver donation might be where kidney donation was back in the 1960s. It's still relatively experimental. There hasn't been enough data accumulated. You may have heard there have been some difficult cases. There have been some fatalities. They closed down the liver donor program in Mount Sinai because one of the donors died. It's not as easy to harvest the liver as it is the kidney. The kidney are 2 distinct kidneys. You can remove one. The liver is one whole organ with different lobes and has a very large blood supply. So it's really not so clear. So to return to our case of this young girl who needed a kidney, so I think we know the answer to the first part of the question. Is it permitted in the eyes of Jewish law for the father to serve as a donor for the kidney, for the first kidney of this girl? So the answer is a resounding yes. Not only is it permitted, it's clearly an extraordinary mitzvah. What about to donate his second kidney? So that already requires a medical analysis. And that already would require a decision whether the risk that he now puts himself in by donating his second kidney would place him into the category of a chassid shote that Rav David Ben Zimra had mentioned, and indeed it probably would be prohibited for him to donate his second kidney, and all the medical centers in the United States refused his offer to donate a second kidney. So ends our section on living organ donation. Let us turn our eyes now to the next page of our handout, entitled "The Deceased Organ Donation in Jewish Law." So we all think that organ donation is a product of the 1960s and the 1970s, but we see here a pasuk from Yechezkel which teaches us otherwise. V'nasati lachem lev chadash, ruach chadasha etein bekir bechem, v'hasirosi es lev ha'even mibsarchem, v'nasati lachem lev basar. I will give you a new heart and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the stone heart, i.e. the heart which is filled with cholesterol and has many plaques, from your body, and will replace it with a heart of flesh. So here we have the very first reference to organ transplantation heralding what would only happen many thousands of years later. But what are the issues with cadaveric or deceased organ donation? The issues of living organ donation, we touched on, deal with your obligation of saving another human life. That obviously doesn't apply for donation after death. once someone dies, we should all live until 120 years old. There are no obligation of mitzvahs anymore. They're chashiv mitzvahs. So then what issues relate to the obligation or the permissibility of donating an organ after death? The issues relate to the prohibitions and obligations that devolve upon the body after death. So there are three major issues that relate to the body when someone passes. One is the obligation to bury. Torah says, Kavorti karenu bayom ahu. You have to bury somebody that very day. And we are the Jews are extraordinarily particular about burying as soon as possible. We in the United States have a custom that we will delay burial a day or two if a family member is arriving from another location out of respect for the deceased. But in Jerusalem, they take this obligation of Kavorti karenu bayom ahu, the obligation to bury on that very day, very seriously. And if someone passes at 2 in the morning, the burial will be at 4 in the morning. There is no delay, not even to the next morning. Burial takes place in Jerusalem 24 hours a day. So there's that obligation of the obligation to bury. Is this an impediment to serving as an organ donor? There's also the prohibition of deriving benefit from the body and the prohibition of desecrating the body. These are all serious obligations which devolve upon the human body after life has left it. So can we waive or pass by these obligations in order to allow the body to be used for organ donation? So the answer here relates to a principle which we mentioned, alluded to before, and that's the principle of pikuach nefesh. To save a human life, one is allowed to violate almost all the prohibitions of the entire Torah. So if indeed this is a case of pikuach nefesh, which obviously saving, you know, donating hearts, livers, kidneys, is considered pikuach nefesh, one would indeed be allowed to violate these prohibitions in order to save a human life. However, there is one big however. The crux of the issue with respect to organ donation in the 20th and 21st century is the source of the organs. From what type of patient do these organs stem from? So we live in a very funny age in the 20th and 21st century. We live in an age where there's two types of deceased. There's two types of cadavers, two types of dead people. There's cadavers whose hearts are beating, and there's cadavers whose hearts are not beating. There's cadavers who are diagnosed with this unique diagnosis of brain death, and there are those who are diagnosed with cardiac death. Now, what do I mean by this? What is this unique condition? And I hasten to add that not everybody who dies, and we should all live to 120, not everybody dies a so-called brain death. Very small percentage of people that pass will die of this particular condition called brain death. Now, if we would have lived 100 years ago, and someone would have had a massive heart attack, God forbid, they would have stopped blood flow to the brain, and the brain would stop functioning and would also die. And the converse was also true. If you had a massive brain injury, your brain, which is the controlling center of breathing, would stop your body breathing, there would be no oxygen to the heart, and your heart would stop beating and you would die. But not so anymore. Now, for the first time in history, in the recent past, there is a temporal dissociation between the death of the heart and the death of the brain. So it's possible for the brain to stop functioning, yet the heart can still beat. How is that possible? Possible with the advent of one device in medicine, and that is the respirator, or ventilator, or life-saving, life support system, whatever synonym you want to call it. When someone, God forbid, has a head trauma from a major accident, EMS rushes onto the scene, they will automatically intubate the patient. They'll put a tube down the patient's lung and connect the patient to a breathing machine. That patient's brain could be completely malfunctioning. No blood flow to that brain. Yet, since oxygen is being delivered artificially to the heart can continue to beat. How long can the heart continue to beat in that circumstance? Not so clear. But the scientists already of antiquity noted that if you took the heart out of the body and you put it on a table, it would continue to beat independently. Now, why God created the body so that the heart has its own independent electrical system? Obviously, we are not privy to that information. But that is a fact. So if I were to ask you, so people in this condition of brain death have no level of consciousness whatsoever. And there are a number of ways to assess this at the bedside and with imaging. And many days of these conferences related to the scientific aspects of the determination of brain death. But if I were to ask you how many people with this diagnosis of brain death ever woke up and left the hospital, anyone want to hazard a guess? So the answer is 0.0. The cases in the Star and the Inquirer notwithstanding. So that means it is clearly a road to death. But the question from a halachic perspective is someone with this diagnosis of brain death halachically dead right now or not? And why is that relevant? It's not only relevant for our obligations of kavortik berenu, you have to bury that person, you're not allowed to desecrate the body, a kohen can't walk into the room if the person's halachically dead. It relates to whether organs can be harvested from that individual. Because if you believe in the eyes of the law that this individual who is brain dead is legally alive according to the eyes of Jewish law, then to harvest the organ from them would be murder. And that's one of the three obligations that you're not allowed to violate to save another human life. However, if you believe, as many do, that the individual diagnosed as brain dead would be halachically dead, then indeed, you are allowed to harvest the organs to save the lives of other people. You're allowed to bypass the obligation of burial and desecration and benefit from the body for pikuach nefesh to save the life of another human being. Now, as you can well imagine, we could spend a fair amount of time discussing the halachic sources. I just wanted to share with you one or two of the primary sources in the that have been discussed by the rabbinic authorities to try and find resolution for this contemporary issue of the definition of death. The first is under the heading primary sources, the first is a Mishnah. Actually, let's do the second one first, the Tractate Yoma, the second source. The context here, and this is something which is also reminiscent of tragedies in the United States and throughout the world that happen, unfortunately, not infrequently enough. The context is a building which collapsed, and there are people under the building, or questionable if there are people under the building, and you need to rescue the people under the rubble. What are your obligations for that rescue? So the context is furthermore that it happens to be the Sabbath. Happens to be Shabbos. So the law is, you're clearly allowed to violate Shabbos to preserve life, but, and there are prohibitions of moving the rubble. Let's say it's a public domain, you're not allowed to pick up the rocks. The rocks themselves may be prohibited from touching on Shabbos. You're not allowed to pick them up and move them a certain distance on the Shabbos. So let's say this happens to be Shabbos. You clearly have a license to violate Shabbos 100% to save the life of another person. However, the minute you know that the person is not alive, you don't have a license to continue to violate Shabbos anymore. So you have to know, if you're uncovering the rubble and you uncover a body, you have to know at which stage the person has the diagnosis of certain death so that you can't violate the Shabbos anymore. So the Mishnah says, Ad heichan hu bodek. Until how far in the body do you examine in order to diagnose death, to determine death? Ad chotmo. V'yesh omrim ad liba. Some say you check up to the nostrils, which is an indication of respiration, and some say you check up to the heart, which is an indication of cardiac function. So without going into the details, and here there has been much written about the analysis of this Talmudic passage, but the creativity of the rabbis and the brilliance of the rabbis in our generation to find material in the Talmudic literature which bears relevance to our contemporary discussions about the diagnosis and the definition of death. Now to return to that Maseches Olos, that's the passage from Olos, where the context there is also for a halachic objective. A halachic objective to determine when tumah is generated. Now, tumah is not something we practice so much today because we don't unfortunately have the temple in Jerusalem, the Beis HaMikdash, but in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, one could not enter the temple unless they were pure. What generated impurity? What was the major source of impurity? Contact with a corpse. So you have to know when an individual was considered dead, so at that point onwards, they would generate impurity, they would generate tumah. So the Mishnah says, Adam eino metame, a person does not generate impurity, i.e. is not considered halachically dead, ad shetetzei nasho, until the soul departs. Now, would that we could find out the exact time that the soul departs. You know, I know there's at least one internist here. number of physicians here. That would be something we would all like to know. It's obviously more a metaphysical concept than a physical concept, when exactly the soul departs. But one of the aspects that it mentions, and I'm skipping towards the second line, towards the end, hutzu roshehem, af al pishim efarkasin tamein. So if somebody's head, God forbid, is decapitated, a physical decapitation, obviously that individual is not alive anymore. So some have argued that in this unique condition of brain death, which is a product of the late 20th century, the individual is clearly not physically decapitated, but is physiologically decapitated. What does that mean? It means there is no connection between the brain and the rest of the body. The headquarters, the command center, is no longer guiding the rest of the body. And the Mishnah says, even if a person has movement after the decapitation, and there's these famous stories from France with the guillotine, of people saying before they went to the guillotine, after my head is lopped off by the guillotine, I'm going to stand up and walk across the stage to this point. And they did so. So whether they did that or not is not the point, but there clearly was movement or walking after, some kind of movement after decapitation. So the fact that the heart is beating, that's not life, according to this position. That is simply the beating of a heart in a lifeless body. So this is one of the sources that has been mentioned. And lest you think that this debate about the diagnosis of death is something which is a product of our generation, it's not true. In the 1700s and 1800s, there was great fear about the possibility of being buried prematurely. And if you read the literature of the 1800s, it's manifest in a lot of the literature. Edgar Allan Poe wrote a classic story about premature burial. Movies, well, not movies, obviously, but a lot of the plays and reference this, and a lot of the short stories reference this. And entrepreneurs took advantage of this concern that people would be buried prematurely. And you have on your handout a picture here of one such entrepreneur who devised this mechanism whereby if a person were buried, he would hook up a pulley system to his fingers and his toes and his head. And on the top of that pulley system was a pole where a bell would ring if the person would move their fingers and toes after they were buried. So hence the term saved by the bell. Now some say it comes from boxing, some say it comes from this. There's a genuine historical debate about what the origin of saved by the bell really comes from. But in that period of time, there was such concern about premature burial that some communities, primarily in Europe, declared, legislated, that no body in their jurisdiction should be buried for 3 days. They had to be kept above ground. A physician had to declare them dead. They had to make sure that gangrene was set in and rigor mortis was setting in. So that there's a tremendous challenge to the Jewish community. We said burial is extremely important. Kavor tikvurenu b'yamahu, you have to bury the same day. And if the law says this person's dead, then you have to bury. So there was a major international debate amongst the rabbinic authorities whether one should accede to the wishes of the local legislature and keep the bodies above ground, or whether they should take the bodies somewhere else and try and bury them immediately. But they were forced in that day to determine whether, in fact, to ascertain the diagnosis of death. And that's another historical chapter which has found reference to our contemporary debate. And as you turn the page, this is not the place to discuss all the halachic decisions, and there are many about this, but suffice it to say there remains a major rabbinic debate. According to many great rabbis, the person diagnosed with brain death is not considered halachically dead, and one could not therefore serve as an organ donor in this situation. According to others, it is clearly permitted to serve as an organ donor. There is no consensus on this. But one very important clarification. On the upper left-hand corner, you see the epitaph of Terry Schiavo. One of the aspects that has pervaded this whole debate and this whole discussion is a misinformation about this condition of brain death and a confusion of brain death with coma or persistent vegetative state. They are very distinct entities. A brain dead individual is someone who is always 100% of the time connected to a respirator. If that respirator is removed, they have absolutely no spontaneous breathing whatsoever. Their heart will stop in a minute if they are removed from the respirator. That is not the case with thousands of people who are tragically in a comatose state or in a persistent vegetative state. One of those such people was Terry Schiavo. Terry Schiavo was not brain dead by any definition of the term brain dead. She was in a state called a persistent vegetative state. The reason why it's called a persistent vegetative state is because the vegetative functions of the body were working, but she lacked consciousness. Her cortex, the large part of the brain, was not functioning, and after they did autopsies, which the husband wanted and the parents didn't want, but they did autopsies and they found that the majority of the cortex of her brain was completely liquefied, simply non-existent. But the base of her brain, the center part of her brain, called the brain stem, was indeed functioning. So I just wanted to share that as an important aspect of clarification. But just to conclude that section, and we'll spend a few moments on the last section, the issues that relate to cadaveric donation or deceased organ donation are different than those of living organ donation. The main crux of the issue today remains a debate about whether brain death is considered halachic death or not halachic death. According to those who accept brain death as halachic death, one is clearly permitted to serve as an organ donor. According to those who reject brain death as halachic death, one is not permitted to serve as an organ donor. People often ask, what about the issue of burial? We have an obligation to bury. If you serve as an organ donor, your organ will not be buried with you. So my suggestion for that is we should put a GPS in each of our organs, and when the time comes, you can just put a you can click where it is, and then you can return it where it needs to be returned. But in all seriousness, the according to our tradition, our bodies are going to regenerate from one bone, which is not, according to our tradition, will never be destroyed, and that is the Etzem Shaluz, the Luz bone. And we all know the bones of Ezekiel that God put together, and there's no doubt about God's ability to restore the human being back to life. But rather than find a bone, Rav Aryeh Kaplan said beautifully, and he said this actually before cloning even came into existence, that our modern analog to this Luz bone from which the entire body will be regenerated is a molecule of DNA. That everybody in this room has unique, distinct DNA. When, God forbid, if something happens to our bodies, our DNA never leaves this world. We can always be reconstituted from our DNA. And if the scientists can do it, I don't think we have any doubt that that God could reconstruct the DNA. And it's interesting, by the way, from a chemical perspective, that no matter what extreme freezing, burning, anything that occurs to the molecules of the DNA, they never are destroyed from the face of the earth. They are always existent in some way, shape, or form on the face of the earth, and they can always be reconstituted at the time of the Tchias HaMeisim to be the unique body that they were. Now, for just a few moments for the last section, and then I look forward to joining with the rabbis for our panel discussion. Until now, the transplant community has only talked about vital organ transplants. What are vital organ transplants? Transplants of organs that are required for the preservation of life. Hearts, livers, lungs, and kidneys, we can't survive without those. But we are now shifting into a new phase in the 21st century, that is transplantation of non-vital organs. What organs are now, in 2007, able to be transplanted that are non-vital? So if you look on your handout entitled Non-Vital Organ Transplants, you're all familiar with this famous case of face transplants. If you looked on the cover of your handout, you see that's the picture of the woman. That is her. And you see how remarkably well she looks after this was a partial face transplant. This wasn't a complete face transplant. The physicians and surgeons are now attempting, they haven't yet done it. There have been two, by the way, face transplants so far. One was here, one was in France, and one was in China. Both of them were victims of being mauled by animals. She was mauled by a dog, and the person in China was attacked by a bear. But this is something which is likely to occur in the future. Now, what is the distinction between vital and non-vital transplants in the eyes of Jewish law? Let me just finish the others first, and then we'll mention that distinction. Number two, hand transplants. There have been roughly 18 individuals, 24 hands have been transplanted in 18 individuals as of 2006. So there are interesting issues here about, from a halachic perspective, also about which hand you put tefillin on. If you have it, didn't have a hand before, you had an amputation, and now you have a new hand. If that hand doesn't have movement, can you put tefillin on it? If it does have movement, can you put tefillin on it? The third type of transplant, a very complex transplant, is the transplant of the larynx. Larynx is the voice box. So there was a man who was otherwise healthy, but couldn't speak. And they did a full larynx transplant, which if you know the head and neck anatomy, it's extraordinarily complicated. The fact that it was successful is nothing short of miraculous. So there, from a halachic perspective, if a man gets a voice box of a woman, is that considered kol isha? Any thoughts on that? And the fourth one... and the fourth one is uterine transplants, which is also something, and here you have two entries from 2007. One is from Obstetrics and Gynecology about harvesting uteruses for transplant, and the other is from the journal Nature. There has been one successful case of transplantation of the human uterus, and it occurred in Saudi Arabia about 2-3 years ago. The woman did not subsequently conceive. Successful, I mean that it was accepted not by the recipient, not rejected. But the recipient didn't give birth to a child. But they are actively working on it. And in New York, they are recruiting candidates for being a recipient of uterus transplant. Now, an interesting halachic question for this would be, if a woman had children, let's say she had a firstborn child and had a pidyon haben, and then she had her uterus removed for a medical reason and then received a uterus transplant from a woman who never had a child and then has another boy, does that second boy need a pidyon haben or not? Another thing for you guys to think about. But what is the... is what? But let's say the first is born regular through her rechem, and the second is born regular through the new rechem. It's a peter rechem for the second rechem. But the truth is, the fact of the matter is, that even if they would do uterine transplants, they would end up doing a C-section for the delivery anyway, so it's probably not halachically relevant. But what are the aspects of non-vital transplant that affect that affect Jewish law? The major distinction is, from the recipient's perspective, what justifies all these recipients for kidneys, lungs, livers, and hearts to undergo the donation, receiving these organs, the transplant, which is clearly, for them, it's a life-saving procedure. It's pikuach nefesh. The transplant itself is risky, and as we mentioned, taking the immunosuppressive medicines for the rest of your life puts you at great risk. Where I work in Montefiore Medical Center is a kidney transplant center. There is not a single day that I work in the emergency department where a transplant patient doesn't come in. And why do they come into the hospital? They don't come in with major illnesses necessarily, although some of them unfortunately do. They come in with a fever of 101 and a sore throat. So if you or I had a minor issue like that, we'd take Tylenol, maybe take antibiotics and stay home. But if you're on immunosuppressive medicines, those medicines not only suppress your body's ability to reject the organ, they suppress your body's ability to reject anything. So you could, God forbid, succumb to the most minor infection if you're a transplant patient. So what allows you to undergo this transplant is the pikuach nefesh for you. But if God forbid you had an amputation, it's not life-threatening to you without the limb. And you also have a prosthesis. And same with the uterus. It's not life-threatening to live without a uterus. It's not life-threatening to live without a larynx. I mean, obviously, it's much better to have one. And it would be extraordinary to have one. But would halacha allow the patient to undergo this kind of risk in order to undergo this transplant? So in conclusion of our initial remarks, we've had an opportunity to address, again in a brief time, understanding fully well that I apologize, both you and I are frustrated with the fact that there's many things we couldn't discuss, but at least we had an opportunity to discuss some aspects of living organ donation, the issues of the lo sa'amod al dam re'echa and the parameters involved with that, cadaveric donation, which primarily the issue revolves around the definition of death and the continuing debate amongst the rabbinic authorities whether brain death is considered halachic death or not, and the issue of new frontiers of transplantation, which will continue to get more exciting on a daily basis. We alluded to stem cell research. Stem cells is one frontier which is also attempting to resolve the transplant problem. It is our fervent hope that maybe the stem cell research will become successful and obviate the need to use deceased or living bodies for transplantation, and we'll have some other halachic issues to talk about instead. Thank you very much, and I look forward to the panel discussion. Now, if I guess Rabbi's Kalimnik, do we have questions? We have questions now? Or? Take a break? 2 minute break. we'll call 5 minute break. 5 minute break.